This is the Medic Cast, May 5th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medic Cast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to episode 116 of the Medic Cast. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. If you are a brand new listener to the Medic Cast, and I know there's quite a few of you out there, you can go ahead and check out the website for the Medic Cast, www.mediccast.com. And over there, you'll find links to all the things I talk about in the podcast category, as well as all of the articles, commentary, and other interesting links that I throw up throughout the course of the week on a variety of different topics, all over at mediccast.com. And you'll find links there to the show notes, to the blog page, and to all of the other programs over at the MedicCast Network. So take an opportunity and get over there and check that out. And of course, for you longtime listeners and contributors to the show, I want to thank you all for coming back for another week here at the Medic Cast. We are going to be digging into quite a bit of good and interesting content this week. And of course, all of that is thanks in part to the contributions of all of the listeners to the show, whether it's through your suggestions, through your comments, through your corrections when I make a mistake, all of those things bring the MedicCast community together and make it just a great place to gather and contribute information. Speaking of gathering and contributing information, you ought to head over and check out the MedicCast forums over at forums.mediccast.com. You can find great information over there and a community effort. If I'm not able to answer your question here on the show, you will definitely get a response from somebody over at the MedicCast forums. It's a great community effort being put together over there. It's a great way for you to contribute back to the show as well and share your information and your experience and your knowledge with the other listeners, as well as get your own questions answered. I pitch in and contribute from time to time over there, but it really very much more a community effort, and I appreciate all of the active members of the MedicCast forums. For those of you that haven't checked it out, get over there and check it out for yourself, forums.mediccast.com. You'll find a great amount of resources there, free to register, free to get set up, and easy to upload things like your own videos, your own photos, great ways to share information with your fellow MedicCast listeners. Speaking of listener contributions, let's jump on in and take a look at this week's listener email. I got a great email question from listener Jason. Jason is an EMTB out in Frederick County, Maryland, and Jason is asking some questions about some things I've talked about, not just on a past episode, but quite frequently on past episodes, and that is community access CPR. Bystander CPR is the linchpin of any emergency response for cardiac arrest, and it is the key item that needs to happen for us to have any good chance at getting any kind of response of circulation, return of spontaneous circulation on the scene. So Jason was asking me, based on the expenses that he, as an American Heart Association instructor, incurs just to teach a class, how he is supposed to teach free or inexpensive community access CPR classes when he has to charge $14 a person just to get their card from the community county training center. And this is a great question, Jason. It's something that everybody that's an instructor for the AHA needs to be aware of. One of the things I do is I go to the community organizations and I talked to them about, look, I would like to teach a class in CPR in your station, in your community organization. It is not free. We do have costs involved, including purchase of a workbook that may or may not be optional based on your training center requirements. But you do have minimum charges for things like administrative fees and getting those cards printed up. And so you can just tell them flat out, look, it's going to cost $14 a person. Now, ordinarily, this costs $50 or $60 a person when a instructor teaches that class, but I'm going to teach it free of charge on my end, but I do need to pass along my costs. Does your organization have any funds for some classes for your membership? And what you may find is that they indeed do have a fund available to help offset some of these costs. So that's one route to go. The second thing I might suggest, Jason, is that you talk to community organizations in general about perhaps offering a grant. Maybe a local company would be interested in underwriting a community CPR effort. Try to look at places of business that your ambulance service has targeted recently or gone to recently on a call. Maybe you've responded for someone in this organization who has had a cardiac event. Well, it's great. It's a great idea to go back to that management and say, I'd like to come in and teach a community CPR class to your organization, and I'd also like to teach another class to a local church group or a local civic organization. Would you be willing to underwrite the cost of teaching those classes? And in many cases, because this is a write-off for these businesses, they need to contribute back to their community. You can even publicize that thanks to their assistance, this class was made available. You know, that's great community PR for these businesses. So don't be afraid to go that route and have them pitch in the $14 a person for a class, not only at their location, but would they be willing to fund one at an outside location? Once you get them to do something like that, you can revisit them once a year and say, I'd like to teach the classes again, just like we did last year. We had a great response, and I made sure to tell everybody that your company helped offset the cost. So that's another route you can go. Third option would be to talk directly to your training center. Talk to the coordinator. Often they have access to resources. They may know of some member of the community at large that would be willing to assist with the offset of those costs for community and civic organizations. They may also be interested in letting you teach one course for free a year in exchange for all of the other things that you do for them. So don't be afraid to ask. The worst thing that can happen is somebody says no. They're not going to get mad at you for offering to teach CPR. That would be ridiculous. So it's an opportunity for you to really get out and shine in the community, and it makes everybody look good. So try some of those options, Jason, and get back to me and let me know how they work out for you. Maybe even call into the voicemail line and leave a message for the other listeners that way. The next item for the listener mail category comes in from listener Mark. He's a listener from Lawrence Fire Department in Lawrence, Indiana. And Mark was asking about where I have my show transcripts, because he uses listening to my program as a way to get Con Ed credit from his organization. And that's a great idea. The important thing to understand, and maybe I misspoke in a past episode, and if I did, I apologize. I don't, at the current time, offer show transcripts per se. I do have show notes and links to all the files. And of course, the show notes list everything that I've covered in that particular episode. So that may be enough for your organization, Mark, but I do not have transcripts of the actual shows and the specific topics covered. That may be something that I offer in the future. If there's enough listener interest, it doesn't happen for free. I would have to go and get a transcriber to go through and listen to and transcribe at least the tips and tricks and the meds of the week type of part of the show. But if that's something that you all would be interested in and would be interested in paying a little bit of something for so I could get it done, let me know and maybe what you would be willing to pay for a copy of the transcript from the show. I'd dress it up and make it look good so that it would be something that would be presentable to your superiors. If that's something you might be interested in, along with references to go with the show notes and everything else, let me know. Would you be interested in paying $5 or $10 per copy of those transcripts sent to you? Let me know, and maybe I can put something like that together for you. And Mark, thanks for your question. If you don't know something or haven't seen something or a link on the site for something, make sure you check in with me, because it may be something you're overlooking, or maybe I need to redesign some things so that the site is easier to navigate. Incidentally, if you are looking for the show notes on the website, on the left-hand column there, you go down to categories and click podcast, and that takes you to a listing of all the podcasts from newest to oldest in chronological order, and you can check back on any past episode and links that I've covered in the past just by going to the website at medicast.com to the blog page /blog, and you'll be able to find the link to the podcast right there. Finally, I'll jump in with a listener email item from our good friend Rick Rosati. Rick can be found over at the Mitigation Journal podcast. If you haven't checked out his show, please take a moment and head over and do that. A great way to learn a little bit more about how to be prepared for those major incidents that might hit your area. And Rick does a good job of talking about disaster preparedness and being able to mitigate the problems that arise during major incidents by being better prepared up front. Rick and I have had an ongoing email discussion regarding an incident that happened in the UK where a paramedic was ordered to stage away from the scene, but in sight of a scene where a teenager had been stabbed, and had to sit there and watch while the teenager slowly bled out in the middle of the street calling out for help while this paramedic was being ordered to remain in her vehicle. And I sent that to Rick, and then Rick found another article this week dealing with an EMT from Rochester who disarmed a knife-wielding man who was stabbing a police officer who had arrived at the scene to help disarm or help take care of a person who was experiencing behavioral problems. And so check out a link in the show notes to that particular article. I just can't imagine. This kind of all happened at one time, and the EMT involved said he just grabbed the hand and wrestled the steak knife out of the guy's hand after he had stabbed the police officer with it at least once. And he just said he was glad that he hadn't been hurt or injured seriously in the middle of that altercation. Another look at scene safety there. And I'm sure Rick will be talking about this on his show, so you can hear his take on this particular link as well. Let's jump on into this week's news, and I'm going to start off with a look at a great story I found coming out of Calgary, Canada. And that area has put together a mobile training unit that actually will go out to units in the field and provide access to field training in a way that makes it a little bit easier for everybody to get their training hours in. Now, this is something we all deal with. We focus on getting our training done, and when are we going to find the extra time to do that on top of the extra shifts we have to work because so many people are working multiple jobs? And how do you do this? Well, Calgary's come up with a unique solution in a mobile training center that costs $387,000. It has a medical simulation system built into it with an ambulance mounted on the back. It provides scenario-based field training for paramedics in the city. It's an amazing system and really is just yet another sign of innovation in how we get information and training out to our providers. Something like I do here, where I go out and give you guys access to news and some refresher training. I think it's just another sign of how people are going to be getting training in the future in EMS. We're going to have to take it to them and not make them come into a central training center all the time and use that valuable time away from their families for something like training that they can get on the job or in other ways. So what a great idea. Check out the link in the show notes. It's a great article, and maybe something if you're part of the training services in your area can get together and maybe put together a system where a whole area can buy something like this, or a region or a county or a state can put together a system that can go around and train on a mobile basis and get out there and see more providers where they're actually doing their work. Moving right along, I want to look at another interesting and pretty amazing story. This comes from a story coming out of Virginia, and I found it over at emsresponder.com. About a week or so ago, 6 tornadoes touched down in an area of Virginia following some pretty severe storms that rolled through, and they really ripped up a 25-mile-long area. Homes were destroyed, parking lots were turned into junkyards as cars were flipped over, shopping centers ripped apart, and yet no one died. And this story talks about the local fire chief who said that he felt they were watched over and very blessed that no one was killed in the face of this tornado. And I have to agree, you know, I'm a person of faith, and I think that people are blessed as well. But I think part of that blessing has to go to the local emergency response system. And that's because when you go down farther in the article, authorities are quoted as saying that people had plenty of warning and were fortunate that the twister struck at the time it did, late afternoon, when people are awake and were able to hear the warnings, heed those warnings, and get out of harm's way or seek shelter in place. And I think that's the lesson to be learned here. This community was not spared the economic damage, but was spared the loss of life that often occurs in these savage storms because of adequate warning and the ability of these people to get in and under shelter. Yes, 200 people were injured, but most of them suffered only minor cuts and scrapes. And that, too, is attributed to the fact that people had a lot of warning that these tornadoes were coming and were able to seek shelter and be able to get out of harm's way as best they could. I'm sure Rick Rosati will be talking about this if he hasn't already seen it, but this is something that we talk about all the time. How would you prepare for these types of situations? Is your family prepared, and do they know what to do when something like this happens in your community? You know, places like this part of Virginia and other areas don't get many tornadoes. So when a severe storm rolls through like this out of the blue, and it's the first time they've had tornadoes in the last 5 or 10 years, how do they know what to do? Well, they know what to do because we teach them what to do. And I think that's the lesson to be gleaned from this particular story. I'll take a move from those first two stories that are a little more uplifting and move into one that kind of startled me and causes me to be a little concerned about the professionalism that occurs out in the communities. You know, it's okay to have some friendly rivalries with neighboring districts as long as it's good-natured and handled appropriately. But when I read an article where Minnesota paramedics are accused of fighting over a patient because that patient may have actually been injured in a neighboring district or on the line, that starts to really point to a problem and not good-natured, I don't know, competition. First of all, we shouldn't be competing for patients. And, you know, I don't know what the situation is here. It's a very short article, but the headline alone alarms me. You can find more on this in the link in the show notes. It'll take you over to the emsresponder.com link. And I just have to say that just the headline alone is alarming to me. It speaks of some sort of territorialism that means that I want the good patients and I want this trauma patient. You know, I have to wonder if it had been somebody that was right on the line that was calling in because they were complaining of a headache, would these people rush to the scene to try to take patients away from each other? Was it just because it was a motor vehicle accident and everybody likes to get into the blood and guts? This is the thing that I'm most concerned about. Why are these people fighting over patients? There's more than enough patients for all of us to go around, and there's certainly no reason to be competing for patients when there's adequate information out there for all of us to share in the learning from each patient encounter. So if you have something like this going on in your area, what do you do to handle it? I'd love to hear back from the listeners on this. And how do you handle when something like this occurs? Because it certainly doesn't make any of us look good when it happens in front of a patient or their loved ones. I'll wrap up with a story I found over at WebMD.com looking at a response of survey from people that they are really having trouble economically keeping up with their medical issues. And this is entitled, "Healthcare is a Victim of the Sick Economy." And Kaiser Family Foundation conducted a telephone poll of 2,003 adults and asked them to rank their healthcare and how it related to their personal economic situation. Nearly 30% of these people said they had considerable trouble trying to pay for medical care or health insurance. And this is no surprise to any of us in the healthcare community. I think we all see those patients that avoid paying for healthcare until they've reached a point where they're so sick that they need emergent care. We see those people that use our emergency health system, like the emergency departments and the ambulance services, as a primary care service because they don't have insurance or don't have access to easily accessible primary care. And so this kind of article is no surprise to me. In fact, the sad part of this is I suspect that many listeners to the Medicast would find themselves in this situation or find themselves in this situation because of the economic situation going on in the country. How do you pay for your health care? Do you have health insurance? Are you being offered good benefits in your workplace? These are all things that people are asked. 17% of the people surveyed said they used almost all of their savings to foot the bill for increased medical costs when they had a serious medical illness, and that medical bills forced 3% of the people polled to declare bankruptcy in the face of those increased medical costs. This is just another indication of the failure of what is supposed to be the best healthcare system in the world, and yet time and again, surveys like this and comparisons to other healthcare systems worldwide point out that it is indeed far from the best medical system in the world. So I'd urge you to respond back to me. You can contact me at email here at podmedic@mac.com. You can also call into the voicemail system at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. If you're listening right now and you want to call in, make sure you pull over first if you're driving and then call in, and I'd love to hear your comments on what you think is the solution for our sick health system here in the United States. Time to look at this week's tip and trick of the week. And I thought this week I would look at acute coronary syndromes. And this is what we most often encounter in the field as a heart attack, a person experiencing a myocardial infarction or an MI. Also, patients with varying forms of angina, most often unstable angina related to an ischemic attack on the heart, where the heart muscle is beginning to starve for oxygen and will eventually cause it to die if not treated and having reoxygenation established again soon. So let's look a little bit at acute coronary syndrome. I've got a great link to an article at emedicine.com in the show notes, as well as a link to some more information over at Medline at the National Institutes of Health. And there's some great information on the various types of angina and heart attack that might be described by patients there. So I urge you to check out the links in the show notes for the eMedicine article. And for those of you that are Medicast Extra listeners, you'll find additional links over at the Medicast Extra site this week as well. So what are we looking at when we talk about acute coronary syndrome, or ACS? You figure out that this is going on based on taking a good history, on signs and symptoms present when you arrive and examine the patient, and sometimes based on their risk factors. So you want to be looking at these kind of things. If you are an ALS provider, of course, you might also be able to determine that a person's having acute coronary syndrome sometimes, and only sometimes, by the results of a 12-lead EKG finding. So that may be also a diagnostic tool. So when we look at acute coronary syndrome, we're really looking at the big three here. We're looking at unstable angina, we're looking at ST elevation MI, and non-ST elevation MI. So you got your STEMIs and your non-STEMIs. And that's why I say EKGs are only partially diagnostic for these type of things, because you may not see ST elevation and definite indications of a heart attack on the EKG tracing for either unstable angina or non-ST elevation MIs. So only some of these myocardial infarctions are going to actually show up on an EKG. So taking good history, taking good family history, as well as looking at a patient's health risks and prior medical history, all can be indicative, along with signs and symptoms, that you may have ACS going on, and you'll want to go ahead and treat that according to your protocols. Now, acute coronary syndrome is most often related to the formation of atherosclerotic plaques. That's where that hardening plaque, that blockage, starts to thin the area through which blood can flow in the arteries. And when this happens in the coronary arteries, they actually begin to occlude. When the patient has an increase in heart rate or an inflammatory response as well can cause this. Often, those blood vessels, as they dilate and constrict throughout the course of their evolution, as you begin to have increased heart rate and need to dilate or constrict based on what's going on with your body's homeostatic influences, you end up having some of that plaque eventually gets kicked loose and will lodge farther down the pipe in a narrow area, causing a complete or partial blockage. And when that happens, the reduced blood flow and the reduced oxygenation of the muscle downstream of that artery causes the heart to begin to have pain, causes the patient to begin to experience ischemia of the heart muscle, and depending on how large an area the downstream portion of that coronary artery serves, can be indeed a fatal event. So what kind of signs and symptoms do we need to be on the lookout for here? Well, generally, chest pain is the big one that we look for, but it's important to keep an open mind and really be looking at the big picture, because not all patients experience that typical crushing chest pain that we associate with a major cardiac event. Yes, they may describe general chest pressure or heaviness. I've had patients tell me, no, it doesn't hurt. It's just a little uncomfortable. Well, remember, pain is something that is very personal. And for some people, they don't describe pain the same way, and they're able to put up with a large amount of pain and wouldn't tell you that it bothers them very much at all. So you need to go with the whole picture and really do a thorough examination. They may experience discomfort or pain in their neck, to their jaw, ear, either left or right arm, and general epigastric pain or discomfort. They may also experience nausea associated with this because of the fact that they're beginning to experience some shock. And of course, shocks-like states move blood flow away from non-vital organs, and people can experience nausea or vomiting associated with the onset of shock. Patients may also have episodes of shortness of breath or diaphoresis, and that is also associated with the fact that they can't catch their breath, they're decreased oxygenation, and they're beginning to experience that shock response so that their skin is beginning to not be perfused as well and begin to experience that sweating that you would see in these patients. These patients may have a history of cardiac conditions. You want to find out about that. You want to find out if they've taken any of their medications. If they've taken nitro and haven't had it resolved, that's the key difference between stable and unstable angina, is the fact that, first of all, stable angina happens as a result of exertion. They know that they can relate it back to exertion. They took their nitroglycerin and the nitro cleared it up along with sitting and resting. If it does not clear up on its own with the treatment of their nitrates and doesn't go away with resting or reoxygenation and hasn't been related to an exertional event like doing some yard work or carrying something strenuous, these patients have unstable angina. And this is important to check out as well. Also remember, patients with other disease process are at increased risk for cardiac events and may not describe symptoms in the same way. Upon a physical assessment, you may find signs of congestive heart failure related to a cardiac event, so they may have fluid building up in their lungs. They may have high or low blood pressure, depending on the part of the heart that is affected or how well the rest of their body symptoms are compensating at this point. Hypotension may be related to a direct ventricular problem related to cardiac ischemia and infarction, and these patients may be experiencing reduced cardiac output and hypotension. They may also be experiencing hypertension because their body is currently compensating for the shock state by increasing blood pressure peripherally. Of course, the issue is that puts additional strain on the heart and it becomes a vicious cycle that will rapidly deteriorate unless treated. You may see signs of things like jugular venous distension, although this will be a very late occurrence in most cases. This would be a sign of right-sided cardiac event where the patient is unable to adequately reduce preload and get that blood through the lungs and into the left side of the heart. And so blood begins to back up on the venous side. So they may have signs of edema in other parts of the body, and you'll see that back up also in the jugular venous distension. So causes, again, are these atherosclerotic plaques, it's hard to say, and also sometimes vasospasm in the coronary arteries. And so what are we going to do to treat these kind of things? Well, we're going to want to make sure that we follow up carefully with getting intravenous access. We want to be able to have an IV in place in case we needed to administer fluids to maintain blood pressure. We need to administer cardiac meds. And if the patient goes into cardiac arrest, we need to be ready to take over and handle CPR immediately. Definitely administer patients oxygen. I talked last week about, do we administer oxygen in high flow or not high flow? If it's a suspected cardiac event, go ahead and get the oxygen that they will stand. If you can get a nasal cannula on them and they seem to do all right and feel better with that amount of oxygenation, go ahead. If it's a major event, I would jump right to the non-rebreather mask and give them 12 to 15 liters of the non-rebreather mask. In some cases, aspirin will be indicated, and in some areas, this is a BLS skill, you can give aspirin, but you would definitely want to give aspirin according to your protocol. Here in Maryland, it's 325 milligrams of the chewable aspirin. Also, you want to get an EKG. If you have access to a 12 lead, you want to definitely run a 12 lead on these patients and evaluate them for the presence of ST elevation in two or more concurrent leads. You also want to get good pulse oximetry, find out how they're oxygenating. This will be a sign of their peripheral perfusion. If you have access to capnography, you may also be able to see how well they are circulating their blood and being able to offload gases, so you'll get a good idea of perfusion on that end. If they're starting to really trap CO2 and not being able to offload CO2 adequately, you may see that on the capnography side as well. Of course, nitro is going to be indicated as well as morphine. Remember, Mona greets all patients with cardiac problems. Mona, morphine, oxygen, nitroglycerin, and aspirin are your big ones to take care of these patients initially, at least. Another intervention that we don't hear talked about very much, at least in the pre-hospital field, is the fact that we need to calm these patients down and we need to help them relax. And I don't do this by giving them the normal useless platitudes like, you're going to be okay, or, you know, we're going to be just fine. You know, that doesn't mean anything to these patients. They know that that's just something you say and it's a cliche. So I try to relax them in other ways. Do that by asking them about their family, asking them about their grandchildren, getting them just to relax and talk about something like, how long have you lived in the area? Just get them to stop thinking about their cardiac symptoms. These patients are very anxious, and that anxiety level also increases their heart rate and their blood pressure and increases the load and oxygen demand on their heart. So anything you can do to calm them down is also definitely a viable way to intervene with these patients, at least while you get other interventions on board. And folks, this too is a BLS skill. So make sure that you utilize this. This is something anybody can do. And I always say, you know, start thinking about the things your grandparents talk about all the time and ask those questions of these patients. Of course, you're going to want to follow your own protocols. These patients are definite for immediate transport. You don't want to stay and play with these patients. You want to get on the road, because definitive treatment, if it is indeed acute coronary syndrome, is getting them to a cath lab and access to cardiology services. And that may not be your local community hospital. You may be going to a specialty center. So you want to make sure you know how your local community and your protocols handle situations like this. So that's a quick overview of acute coronary syndrome. Just wanted to kind of revisit that topic and give you a sense of how acute coronary syndrome can present in many different ways and some ideas on the best ways to initially treat that within your protocols. Since we've been talking about cardiac issues, I think for the med of the week this week, I'll look at calcium channel blockers. I've looked at this med before, or at least particular versions of this med. One of the things that many ALS services use is a calcium channel blocker to handle things like unstable AFib. And in this case, you would be administering diltiazem, or in some cases or areas, verapamil. These are both calcium channel blockers. But a lot of patients take calcium channel blockers. They'll show up on their med lists. And so it's important for you to understand that they're taking this for a cardiac problem and exactly how this med works. Calcium channel blockers are based on the effect that muscular contraction relies on the movement of these positive ions in and out of the muscle cells. And it's this cascade of calcium in and potassium out that causes these muscles to contract. the calcium rushing into the muscle, the amount of calcium that rushes in and through these pathways causes the muscle to rapidly contract. And so calcium rushing into a cardiac cell causes it to contract and increases contractility and reactivity. And also in areas of smooth muscle, like the venous and arterial systems, you will cause vasoconstriction. So again, calcium is an important part of that process. So calcium channel blockers block that channel, slow down the movement of calcium from the bloodstream, the extracellular space, into the intracellular space. And they work in that way to encourage vasodilation and to decrease the contraction of the muscles, in this case specifically the cardiac muscle. And so that's exactly how the calcium channel blockers work to have their reduced effect on cardiac load and reduced vasoconstriction peripherally. Calcium channel blockers are used for a couple of different things when they're prescribed to patients. They are used to treat high blood pressure, and we already talked about how that mechanism works. They are also used in patients that are experiencing ongoing issues with angina, and it's used as a dysrhythmic or an antiarrhythmic medication. And this is in cases of AFib, where it actually slows response of the heart rate down. Different calcium channel blockers work better with different parts of that system. So some are better at vasodilation and have less cardiac effects. Others are much more strongly acting on the cardiac muscle itself and don't have as much of a vasodilatory effect. So different calcium channel blockers are out there and have different effects. And so you need to just understand that when you look up a medication and you see it's a calcium channel blocker, it could be administered and prescribed to these patients for a variety of reasons, among them high blood pressure, angina, or existing history of AFib or other type of heart dysrhythmia. And so you just need to know that. The big ones we usually see are verapamil, diltiazem, as well as amlodipine and some other medications that you may find out there. And that's just some of them. Diltiazem is also known as Cardizem. Verapamil is known as Calan or Isoptin or other, just different names. But when you look them up in your drug guide, you're going to find that it's called a calcium channel blocker. And now you know a little bit more about how calcium channel blockers interact with the body. Let's look real quick at some of these side effects of calcium channel blockers. And that's because we have these elderly patients who take these medications, and many times they forget they take medications or they took too much of a medication. They doubled up on something. And that can cause an increased effect and increased profile of side effects. Calcium channel blockers are known to have a relationship to constipation as well as nausea, headache. They may also cause peripheral edema as the body becomes more vasodilated and the cardiac muscle doesn't have to work as hard. It slows down in the amount of blood pressure that's pushing the fluid out of the intravascular space or out of the extravascular space back into the intravascular space. And so you end up having an increase in swelling in the legs and other parts of the body. So you want to look for signs of edema. They may have some extreme hypotension, low blood pressure related to this, and related to that even drowsiness or dizziness related to that low blood pressure. So some drugs have more of an effect of this. We see increase in low blood pressure related to diltiazem and verapamil when given in the field. And so whenever you have these meds, you want to be able to counteract them. And the drug to use when counteracting a calcium channel blocker overdose is indeed calcium chloride. Give them more calcium and it will override some of that blockage and blockade and be able to push on past and increase the amount of calcium available to their muscles. And so that's always something to keep in the back of your mind when you're giving a calcium channel blocker, is to be prepared to manage an immediate low blood pressure, hypotensive response, and be prepared to give calcium chloride as a sort of an antidote to an increased reaction to these medications. So that's a quick look at calcium channel blockers, some of the things you want to keep an eye out for them, and some of the ways that calcium channel blockers work. And that's this week's MedicCast Med of the Week. And you know what? That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show this week and remind you that you can find links to everything I talked about in this week's episode over at the show notes page, and that can be found at the MedicCast blog. MedicCast.com/blog will get you to the link for the blog, and in the podcast category there, you can find all of the links in the show notes. If you'd like to comment on this or any of the episodes of the MedicCast or on an article over at the website, please get back in touch with me by email at podmedic@mac.com. Or if you'd like to share your comments live with the listeners, you can call into the MedicCast voicemail line and leave a message there, 941-306-3342. Put that in your cell phone there, folks, and when you listen to the show and you want to call in with a comment, you can do it right away by calling 941-30-MEDIC, 941-306-3342. I'll wrap up now with some great PodSafe music from P.W. Fenton and the Second Ward. This song called Silent Treatment is one I haven't played in a really long time, but I think you'll enjoy it, and I will use it to send you on your merry way. So until next time, folks, when I'll be back with another episode of the MedicCast, I want to remind all of you that I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and remember, folks, until next time, scene safety, BSI. Something.